Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a video and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Today, I'm privileged and honored to welcome someone who I can call an Indophile from Scotland, who probably knows India better than I do, Aline Dobby. Aline, welcome to the show.
Namaskar. It is very, very nice to be with you on this podcast, and I'm delighted to be once again invited to talk about India, which is the land of my birth.
Wonderful. So, as you just mentioned, Aline was born in India, and in her own words, she's a child of independence with very strong bonds to this country. Five generations on one side and four on the other have served, worked, lived, loved, and died in India. Aline is the author of four books and A Quick Look at India. She's highly respected and promotes India all over the world. She was awarded the Pride of India Gold Award, the Art and Culture Award presented to her in Parliament, and she sits on Foundation Board of His Highness Udaipur Mewar Maharana Foundation. So Aline, tell me, what would you say are three key milestones in your life or your career?
Well, the first one would, of course, be that I was born in India. Not that I had much to say about that. I was born there. But I consider, looking back, that I was hugely lucky, privileged to have had that childhood, that babyhood, in an ancient land that was now making these giant steps into the modern world. And though people talk about Indian independence, I actually don't like that term. I prefer India's nationhood, because India is a land of antiquity that had withstood all sorts of onslaughts and changes, and now in 1947, when I was but a mere babe, had reached its nationhood. And that is how I prefer to refer to it.
Okay.
Then comes along in my very early 20s, when I'm 22, I meet Graham and I marry him, and then the next thing we have two fine sons. And in fact, if I think about it, 50 years ago, exactly today,
oh wow, congratulations.
I was going into the first, 50 years ago today, I was going into the first stages of labor for my first son.
Okay.
So that was a very special time, of course, for any young woman. And then to be married to a fine man and two lovely sons. And then life takes its course, and it was only in 1997 that the children having grown up and in their own lives and so on, Graham and I could really afford to go out to India at that very special time.
Okay.
And so came out to India at her 50th, and for Graham it was a new experience completely, but for me it was, well, it was almost like a pilgrimage, actually, to the land of my birth. And I so enjoyed it, and then everybody said, oh, Rob, rather sort of superficially, why don't you write a book? And I said, oh, well, I don't know. And then Graham said, because our eldest, by this point, was going back to his second tour as an army officer in Bosnia, look, take your mind off it. I bet you couldn't write a book. So I said, oh, well, I bet you I could.
Amazing. And I did. Okay.
And then the first book took time to get published, and then there was the second book, and then the third book. So, India, the Peacock's Call, the Tiger's Roar, the Elephant's Blessing came along. And then in 2010, I was invited to write by a different publisher, Quick Look at India, to try and help people understand this amazing nation. And I did, but it was a challenge, because it had to be in 25,000 words. That's all.
Okay.
So we've been coming back to India every year, and normally at this time of the year, we would be packing our bags and looking forward to winging our way out to India. But as you know, the world is under a challenge.
I agree. Well, it'll come again, I'm sure, and you'll be back in India. We'll see you here very soon. So tell me, you know, when you returned in 1997, which was after a long gap.
Yes.
What? And that was also 6 years after the liberalization of India started.
Yes.
Under Prime Minister Narasimha Rao. What was your impression of this India versus what your perceptions were?
Yes, it was quite astonishing because in a way, emotion clouded an awful lot of it. But once that subsided, there was this sense of the modern India. There were larger airports, huge crowds, beautiful hotels, all sorts of wonderful things. I was able to go and see great heritage sites that, of course, as a child growing up, one didn't get to do that. Correct. You know, tourism hadn't started in India in the 50s. And so there was a lot that was there that was, as it were, you were scratching the surface. And it was fascinating. And I was enchanted again.
Mm-hmm.
Then the rusty Hindi Urdu came back to the fore. Quite amazingly so, actually.
Okay.
And Graham was intrigued by India, and that was the start of coming back and coming back and returning. And the change in India over this last 23 years has been phenomenal, and largely for the good. Definitely for the good.
When you look at India, and when you think about all the other places that you have traveled to and lived in, I mean, I know you are a little partial towards India, but what are your general impressions of how India has been growing?
Largely, I would say India is doing well. After all, it is a vast challenge. When you think of the childhood that I had, was in a land of 400 million people with the same landmass. Now you've got 1.3 billion.
Correct.
Whichever government's in power has to cope with that challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to bring the people along. India's science and engineering, all those amazing things that were there in antiquity have come to the fore, and the world is amazed because the world is naive. The world is ignorant. They didn't, by and large, understand India's legacy to the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the early stuff. Any of us who are students of history know those things, and we keep learning.
Mm-hmm.
But people didn't know this. So India now is putting its foot forward, and I think is on the cusp of the potential for huge greatness, providing she handles it well.
Okay. Very interesting. So, you know, when I was reading about you, Aline, I was fascinated to read that in 1961, when you were flying from Bombay to London, you met our former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. Tell me about this interaction.
Yes. Well, you know, in those days, I was at boarding school in England, so I'd be back and forth. And my chosen airline was Air India, which was superbly run by a certain wonderful man called J.R.D. Tartt, as you would know. And there we were. I was in Calcutta with the parents. And, of course, I'd flown into the hub, which was Mumbai. And along came the Rajiv and his brother, Sanjay.
Mm-hmm.
And we all set off in the plane. And then the pilot decided that he wasn't happy with things. He was just about to take off, and he decided to shut his engines and come back.
Mm-hmm.
So we all sat on the tarmac. Now imagine this, you couldn't do this now, but we sat on chairs on the tarmac whilst the plane was tweaked to his satisfaction. So when we got back on the plane, I was sitting in the seat, and Rajiv was right behind me, and Sanjay, and one or two other people I knew, because you get quite blasé in your teens if you're doing this sort of thing all the time.
Right.
And Rajiv was quiet and very sweet and very courteous, not self-effacing, but not pushing himself forward.
Mm-hmm.
His younger brother was the exact opposite.
Okay.
We all went along quite happily because Rajiv would be 2 years exactly older than me. So we were all young teenagers, all sort of boasting and talking and chattering and behaving as teenagers do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I got to know him a little bit. And of course, I'd known his cousins, the Nehru boys, as a toddler growing up in places like Mongir and then in Calcutta, because their father, Balu Nehru, who was a colleague of my father's in what is now known as ITC.
Correct.
Yes, that's how I knew slightly Rajiv, yes.
Wonderful. And, you know, again, one of your other articles that I was reading, you've commented that India should be a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. What are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely. She has just taken up her two-year posting as a temporary member yet again.
A temporary member, but not a permanent member.
No, but as I understand it, she was offered permanent membership mm-hmm. of the Security Council, but mm-hmm. for some reason, Pandit Nehru declined it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think that this is the time when the United Nations is actually commemorating 75 years of its sort of inception and being at mm-hmm. the sort of initiating conference in London.
Yeah.
Why Nehru declined it, I can't understand, because he sort of made it possible for China to take that place. And circumstances and world events have shown that mm-hmm. it would have been entirely right that India should have been where she is. And of course, India in all these intervening years mm-hmm. has been so good in providing UN forces for trouble spots.
Yes. Yes.
So yes, I think it should be a permanent.
It is the largest provider of security forces to the UN.
Well, there you are. That mm-hmm. answers my question.
So, you know, again, as someone who, if I can use the word inside outsider, who has constantly been in love with India, come back so many times, born in India. When you look at India, what are some of the things that we should be doing differently to be able to really aspire to get the kind of stature that we deserve as a major nation in the world?
Well, that's one of those how long is a piece of string sort of questions. But on the deeper side, I think at the moment, we are in a very critical stage.
Hmm.
Now, to me, bearing in mind the events in the United States last week and what is going to unfold, India is the bulwark with the United Kingdom and our friends in Australia and New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly our friends in Canada. Now, I've got that caveat for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine this. There is an American sedan going along a road, mm-hmm. and the driver and the co-driver, the driver becomes a little sleepy and tired. So he changes and he allows the co-driver to take the thing. His windscreen is slightly marred
mm-hmm.
by a sort of virtue signaling sort of snowstorm.
Mm-hmm.
The windows are slightly darkened and blackened. And in the back seat, there is someone who has been on a road before, mm-hmm. but this is a different road now. So backseat driving may not actually serve him so well.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got that American car. Now I would say, let us think hard about the British Land Rover Discovery
mm-hmm.
that is the manufactured by India,
mm-hmm.
let the drivers in the front be absolutely like this,
mm-hmm.
speaking both Hindi
mm-hmm.
and English.
Mm-hmm.
Let the backseat passengers be robust people who understand in their various British, Australian, New Zealand, mm-hmm. and maybe Canadian accents,
okay.
where we are going, because we were there before when the world was threatened, and we are being threatened at the moment, I think. Okay. And it is a difficult time for democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Why I had a caveat about Canada is not because I don't like Canadians and think it's a wonderful country. It's because they have done rather a lot of virtue signaling recently,
mm-hmm.
and they've got to sort out their values.
Correct.
But Australia and New Zealand and ourselves, we know. And then you've got a European charabanc, a sort of coach which has got 27 people in it, and you've got the driver who wants to go only one way and he only speaks German, and then you've got a French excitable fellow, and you've got a few other people who are all wanting to do what they want to do,
mm-hmm.
and maybe the Dutch are saying, well, why couldn't we go by canal? So I think we have to, my analogy is, let us concentrate on this British Land Rover mm-hmm. of Discovery mm-hmm. with its pride of India
mm-hmm.
and go forward together, because we're going to need strength and resolution to withstand totalitarianism and people who wish to perhaps change democracy or diminish it or indeed completely desecrate it.
Very interesting. So let's talk about the article that you wrote on the India-China War of 1962 on the 50th anniversary. And, you know, that is particularly, I mean, I really enjoyed reading that article, and more so because my father served in the army in 1962 in the war. Given the face-off that we are seeing between India and China now, what are your thoughts on the relationships between India and China?
India has to remain strong, united, make sure her armed forces are completely up to scratch, because in 1962 they weren't. As you know, what I said in that article, I was there, a mere 16-year-old tasked to try and organize the evacuation of Tea Garden personnel. As I said to my uncle and my father, how can I do this? And they said, Aileen, you've got a very agile, sensible mind. Of course you can do it. And of course you speak Hindi. You've got to understand that there was the Calcutta of that day. There weren't all these wonderful hotels and things. You had to organize so that these people carrying one suitcase and all their children were put up in various people's houses. My own parents put up a family with four children, two sets of twins, one of them only 3 months old. China had stolen a march on India, and because the then rulers perhaps felt threatened by the idea of armed forces, because they had the example of Pakistan, they had diminished India's armed forces. That mustn't happen ever, ever again.
Okay.
India must have this sense of, you know, that old thing, tryst with destiny. I'm thinking, as I speak, India must be resolute. And what she mustn't do is allow these curious things of extinction rebellion, this idea of Black Lives Matter, that this business of trying to blame white people for being white, wokeness. Forget all that. India has the purity of antiquity from the beginning of any form of written history. And from that, you can learn. And yes, mistakes are made. Bad mistakes are made. We've all made them. But with that resolution, India with can stand and has to, for the sake of us all.
Amazing. So I mean, given the time that I have, let's talk about your two awards, the Pride of India Gold Award and the Art and Culture Award. Tell me about these two awards and why you received these.
The Pride of India Gold Award in 2006, I think, was at the conclusion of having written three books on India. The third book was written at the urgent request of Amitabh Kant and another man who will mean something to you, Shaktikanta Das, currently the governor of the Reserve Bank of India. But at that stage, he was the director of tourism for Tamil Nadu. And after the Asian tsunami, they both said, please, Aileen, write a third book on southern India. So when I'd achieved that, then I think people thought, well, I'd done my bit to help promote India, and I received the Pride of India Gold Award. Just recently, when I received the Art and Culture Award from the India Business Group, that was in 2019. And that again is because I've done my utmost to promote India and British goodwill. And I happen to be a great believer in the United Kingdom. I may be a Scot, but I'm a loyal British person. We have these problems in our country currently, and I do not espouse the cause of independence. I belong as a proud British person.
Well said. Well said. So I'm going to now move to the last segment of our conversation. There are some questions for you personally. Tell me, you know, you keep writing, you write on multiple subjects. I mean, there's so much energy that I see even while talking to you. Who or what inspires you?
Well, when I write about India, it's quite simple. India inspires me. When I write about something else, it's usually because there's the kernel of a thought and you develop it and then you want to write. I've written since I was quite young at boarding school. And these days, of course, to write is so easy because with all the various platforms, providing you're being constructive, people want to hear what you've got to say.
Sure.
And of course, I promote Indian tourism. I mean, that I care passionately about the current situation where the hospitality tourism has been decimated there and here. Believe me, here. I mean, with COVID, it's been shocking and so sad. And I just want to promote that because I just think that India has so much diversity of attraction. I mean, whatever you want to come and enjoy in, you can do it in India, be it luxury hotels, be it mountains, be it beaches, be it valleys, be it backwaters, and a sunrise in India. You know, the first thing I do when I arrive in India, providing I'm not too jet-lagged, if I'm in a place, I get up early, I go onto the roof of a building or wherever I can to see the sunrise. And there are some sunrises that just absolutely take your breath away. One that I had last year was, I was a guest of Gaj Singh of Maharaja Jodhpur. And we were staying at his Sardar Samand Palace, which is a sort of poem to, how can I say, 30s Art Deco. And I'd been told the sunrise was superb over the lake. And I got up at about 6:15 and it was cold, believe me, the desert cold. And I was sitting waiting on the balcony. And then suddenly there's this line of carmine across the lake. And the peacocks are calling and the owl hoots. And then the carmine spreads and comes up and starts invading the water. And then suddenly the sun bursts through and you've got this great crimson orb and it fills the lake. And that's the sunrise.
Amazing.
Equally, you can go somewhere and see a sunset. Now, I'm never happier than when I'm in a very favorite place, staying at Kumarakam Lake Resort, and we'll be in the infinity pool and we're waiting for the sunset, and if you're lucky, it'll be a clear one over Lake Vembanad, and hopefully I've got a legendary mojito in my hand and I'm just sitting with my elbows on the edge of the infinity pool and the flying foxes go over and the cormorants are wheeling and the sun slowly goes down, and again, if it's clarity, then you get this gorgeous crimson view. Well, how can you go past that?
Amazing. So, you know, I mean, what you're defining it, I mean, I can almost visualize a sunrise and a sunset. I mean, I think that's what makes such an incredible author that you are. I mean, you know, your definitions are incredible. So I now have time for just one more question, and I have so many questions to ask you, but I'm going to ask you this one question on failure. And the reason failure. And the reason I'm going to ask you this question is that I've often said that in India, or for that matter, in a large part of the developing world, parents don't teach their children it's okay to fail.
Yes.
We're always taught you got to be first, get
you've got to achieve, etc.
And you know, you've been to India every year. I've said that that manifests itself in our behavior patterns, where you suddenly start to see 9 cars in a 3-lane at a 3-lane traffic light, everyone trying to get up right in front, or a plane full of Indians landing and the guy sitting in coach right on the last row is the one to rush out first. So my question to you is that we all fail.
Yeah.
We all learn.
Yes.
My question to you, Aline, is what have been some of your learnings from some of your mistakes or failures?
Well, God, honestly, I'm nearly 75, so there have been a fair amount on the way. But all you can do is learn from those failures, and providing you didn't do something bad or wrong, failing is not to be wrong. Failing is not to be bad. Failing is because you tried your best, but that thing that you aspired to or whatever didn't work out. Then just learn from it. I mean, now as a grandmother, one is often talking like this carefully to one's grandchildren because I'm not sure if you're a grandparent yet, but we have 5 of them, and the eldest is going to be 20 this year. Now, you can try and tell a 20-year-old if and when he's failed, okay, sweetheart, it's not so bad. You pick yourself up on all those trite things, but you've got to do more than that. You've got to show him that he must look inside himself and see what he could have done differently. He must do, in fact, a SWOT. As a management man, you would know, he must always do a SWOT on himself.
Correct.
And never give up, but learn from that.
Mm.
And each one of us has, at some stage, done that, unless that person was so privileged or whatever, that they were always sort of excused their failures. That, as a parent, is not doing any good. That's nor would it be as a management leader. You've got to help the person get past whatever was the failure. That's all I can say. Do your best.
I agree. No, very wise words indeed. Aline, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you. I hope I can chat with you once again and go into a little more detail about India. And I sincerely hope I will see you in India sooner than later.
Definitely.
But thank you again very much.
Fimalingi.
Absolutely. Fimalingi.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast. A platform that brings you knowledge, experience and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website www.tbcy.in to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.